Good morning. This is Lori Mercier, and I'm speaking to Roberto Gonzalez, a professor of anthropology at San Jose State University, whose recent work has focused on militarization and culture in the United States. He's the author of many articles and books, including Anthropologists in the Public Sphere, Speaking Out on War, Peace, and American Power, American Counterinsurgency, Human Science and the Human Terrain, Militarizing Culture, Essays on the Warfare State, and most recently, War Virtually, The Quest to Automate Conflict, Militarize Data, and Predict the Future. He's working on a new book about algorithmic policing in the United States. Today, we're talking about how Silicon Valley is transforming the military-industrial complex. Welcome to KABU, Roberto Gonzalez.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you've written about how big tech is increasingly fused with the military-industrial complex. Tell us how and why this happened.
Well, what's happening now is part of a much longer process that began in the 1950s with the emergence of the Silicon Valley region as a major site for R&D that was largely financed by the U.S. military and intelligence agencies during the Cold War. Silicon Valley, I think, and the United States as a whole, has this image of the region as a place that was built up by these savvy, independent, maverick entrepreneur engineers who built fantastic new technologies like semiconductors and the internet with their own genius, largely self-funded. That's not the case at all. In fact, the entire region developed largely through Cold War funding. For decades, the largest employer in the area was not Atari or Apple or Ampex. It was Lockheed Martin. And Lockheed Martin continues to be a very large economic power in the region. So what's happened over the past 20 years or so is that you have a new generation of companies that collectively we call big tech that include household names like Microsoft, Google, Oracle, Amazon, some of which are not even based in the San Francisco Bay Area or Silicon Valley, but collectively are still described as Silicon Valley. And what's happened with these big tech firms over the past 10 years in particular is that they've become more and more invested in seeking out large multi-year, multi-billion dollar Pentagon contracts. So that's really what I've been most interested in documenting is the recent phase in this long-term process of the militarization of the tech industry that really stretches back to its origins.
Now, you trace this more recent marriage, I suppose, back to 2011 when President Obama authorized the drone strike that assassinated Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S.-born Muslim cleric. And although Obama and subsequent administrations and the Department of Defense have touted the drone's precision, as you document, the so-called advanced technology presents many problems. What are some of the problems associated with drone warfare?
Right. Well, I think to understand some of the problems, one needs to put this in again, in historical perspective. The period between 2011 and 2015 or 2016 was critical for the emphasis on a new form of high tech or what at the time was called data-driven warfare. The historical context is this, that it emerged at a time when it was becoming increasingly clear that the United States military's commitment to the Petraeus-era counterinsurgency model, boots on the ground, social scientists on the ground, a kind of throwback almost to Vietnam-era counterinsurgency tactics, that strategy was failing by 2010, 2011. And so the Obama administration came in and began to explore new, really tech-focused alternatives to classic counterinsurgency. And what developed out of that was what some have called computational counterinsurgency. So basically using all kinds of big data collected from drones, surveillance drones, collected from other kinds of sensors, from satellites, from internet usage patterns, from cell phone patterns, and really just crunch those numbers to come up with lists of potential terrorists or potential insurgents. And what emerged out of that were these kinds of essentially hit lists. And because these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were becoming increasingly unpopular with Americans, and U.S. troop casualty counts were increasing. Drone warfare, or one way of thinking of this is war by remote control, became more and more popular during the 2010s. The advantages, of course, are potentially the fewer deaths of U.S. servicemen and women. But the downside, as we know from lots of investigative reports that have been done since that time, is that it also resulted in large numbers of civilian casualties in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other theaters in the war on terror. So that is the big downside. Apart from the sheer violence of civilian casualties, large numbers of civilian casualties, numbering in the tens of thousands if we add up Iraq and Afghanistan together, then there's also a psychological component. And we know quite a lot now about the negative psychological impact of drone warfare on people, perhaps who were never physically hurt by this war by remote control, but for years carried this burden of fear and terror of being constantly subjected to surveillance and potential violence inflicted by drones. Interestingly, and this is, I think, less well known to the public, drone warfare has also, at least in its remote controlled form, led to significant patterns of mental health problems among U.S. drone crews. Now, for years, critics of drone warfare said, well, you know, these troops are just, they're like video gamers, right? I mean, they're basically killing with impunity and doing so without any compunction or sense of guilt. In reality, it turns out, now that there's been quite a bit of research on this, drone warfare has had a serious psychological impact on drone crews themselves. I'm talking about, again, U.S. servicemen and women from the Air Force who are essentially pulling the trigger from thousands of miles away without fully knowing whether or not their actions will result in civilian casualties or not. So what's emerged out of this is patterns of post-traumatic stress disorder, not too much unlike what one might expect from troops on the ground physically in a battle space, in an actual battle space, as opposed to a virtual one.
And that's despite the military's training of these drone technicians to thinking that these are merely video games. I mean, isn't much the training about creating this kind of video game atmosphere?
Yes, that's essentially a part of the training, as I understand it, is that it's the kind of classic training that I think all modern military personnel go through, not just in the U.S., but in other countries, which is the dehumanization and the objectification of the target. What's interesting in the case of remote control drone warfare, which continues to be the primary use of drones, as opposed to, say, autonomous or fully autonomous drones that pick their own targets. But when it comes to remote control, you've got a paradox, essentially. So you've got, on the one hand, an increase in the distance between the target and the killer. On the other hand, you've got a compression of space to the extent that the drone crews are sometimes monitoring a target for days or weeks at a time with a fine enough video resolution that they can see that this person living the details of their everyday life as they go from one area to another, as they go on outings, perhaps with their families or friends, as they engage in community activities, so that they begin to see the target themselves as an actual person, despite the far geographic distance. And that is very likely the cause of the PTSD, is the psychological proximity that this kind of drone warfare brings with it.
I don't know if you've seen the powerful recent film From Ground Zero, which includes 22 short films by different filmmakers about life in Gaza during warfare. But in each of the 22 films, or short films, there's the constant buzzing sound of drones overhead. So it was very striking to me that no one in Gaza can escape the terrifying sights and sounds of 24/7 drone surveillance. But despite this targeted surveillance and so-called advanced technology, for the last 15 months, Israel has indiscriminately dropped U.S.-made bombs on families in tents, hospitals, ambulances, everywhere and everyone. So what is the argument about Israel's so-called superior technology if the results, genocide, are the same as 20th century warfare?
That is the question. I think that is the reason that I'm so critical of where things are headed. I mean, despite the continuing rhetoric about the advanced technology leading to greater and greater surgical precision, to use one of the phrases that, for example, the Defense Department had long used, or the kinds of claims that the Israeli Defense Ministry has made about the accuracy and precision of its strikes on the ground, the reality is, as you say, in Gaza, many, many civilian casualties, primarily women and children, the razing of entire communities, the destruction of key infrastructural, hospitals, electricity grids, that kind of thing. I think what makes the war in Gaza quite strikingly different from the U.S. war on terror is the fact that Israel, this has now been widely reported, has been using a number of artificial intelligence-enabled technologies. And what this has led to, and I think this is what we should all be concerned about, is the acceleration of warfare, so that the vast scale of both physical as well as infrastructural destruction in a place like Gaza is partially the result of the acceleration of the attacks. So what AI does is to speed things up. It means that decisions are made automatically, autonomously, in some cases, with such rapidity that there is not enough time for a human actor to intervene if, for example, if there's some kind of an error in the data coming in. And so this is something I think that we should all be paying attention to. And it's happening if we look beyond the war in Gaza, if we look beyond the war in Ukraine, if we think about the global geopolitical context of what some people call an AI arms race between the United States and China. Well, in many ways, we're back to a kind of Cold War nuclear arms race kind of mentality. And again, I think this is something that we should all be paying attention to, be concerned about, be in contact with our elected officials about our concerns, because there is I think, a level of fear and also, frankly, hype around this idea of an AI arms race and the need for the United States to remain the world's, sole superpower, et cetera, that's driving this, that it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, I now understand why you have been so critical about big tech's entry into, the long-standing arena of the Pentagon's horribly bloated and corrupt budget, which includes a revolving door between Congress and Department of Defense officials and boards of military contractors. So the big tech entry has really raised, it sounds like, has really raised the level of danger of the future of warfare. And why are these contracts so secret, and how have they evaded scrutiny?
Well, a lot of these contracts are classified contracts. And, I think the argument is because the technologies are so new, or the uses are so sort of sensitive in terms of national security, that the details in terms of the amounts of the contract should not be publicized, nor the details about what the contracts are for. The CIA, of course, has a long history of working in a classified fashion. The CIA, unlike the military, reports to the executive branch directly. So there's all kinds of political reasons in terms of why those budgets continue to be classified. But beyond that, I mean, even for those contracts that are not classified, if one is doing research on the contracts themselves, it's an incredibly complex and confusing process, because let's say you have a $10 billion contract that's spread out over a 5-year period that's divided up between two major contractors. Each of those major contractors may well have 5 or 10 or 15 subcontractors that it then parcels the work out to. So very quickly becomes a complicated picture to get precise dollar amounts or to get a precise picture of what exactly a particular company is working on in a, within a larger framework. The person that I know in the institution, the organization that I think is doing the best work in this area, and I encourage all of your listeners to check it out, there's a nonprofit research group called Tech Inquiry, and their website is techinquiry.org. And they've got a fantastic resource, which is a searchable database of military contracts that is greatly useful to researchers, reporters, and the citizens as a whole, anybody interested in this topic, so that you can search, for example, a particular company like Anduril Industries or Palantir or Google and find out what contracts they've gotten, at least technically how they're listed in the congressional budget reports. And this is all essentially it's aggregating openly accessible information and putting it in one place. The person that got this off the ground, he's a very interesting person by the name of Jack Polson. He's a doctor of mathematics. He's a former senior scientist at Google, and then decided to quit his job, I believe in 2017 or 2018, as the first widely publicized Google military contracts came to light. And he published, he caught my attention because of an op-ed he wrote in the New York Times titled, "I used to work for Google, but I don't anymore. I'm a conscientious objector," or something along those lines. And what he did with his career in his post-Google career is just fascinating in terms of doing the general public and the taxpayers a great service by putting his mathematical skills to work to do a kind of public interest database on military industrial contracts in the tech sector.
Thanks for that recommendation, and we will link to it on the KBOO website. This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm speaking with Professor Roberto Gonzalez, professor at San Jose State University, about how big tech and Silicon Valley are transforming the military-industrial complex. Well, Professor Gonzalez, we've seen Elon Musk shadowing Trump for months, and now the other tech billionaires have joined the Trump bandwagon. What's the significance of their influence? I mean, already with major DoD contracts.
Well, it's hard to know for sure. You know, we're talking about apart from people with very large companies that they manage, that they direct, also with very large egos. And given the fact that someone like Elon Musk and President Trump, although they may be getting along fine now, it's hard to say what their relationship might look like 6 months from now. What I will say that is this, that apart from Elon Musk, there are many, many other tech executives that have very quickly aligned themselves with the Trump administration. During the campaign, there were some interest by the press on people like Peter Thiel, who co-founded Palantir Industries, and Palmer Luckey, who is the CEO of Anduril Industries, which is another tech company very much invested in AI technologies and becoming increasingly important in the business of Pentagon contracts. And then also you've got a number of people from the venture capital world. And it's important not to leave the VC investors out of this discussion either. Venture capital, of course, you know, these are financiers, big time investors who are looking for oftentimes startup companies, small startups, so that they can fund these. And then if the small startups either get acquired or go public, become publicly traded corporations, then that VC investment pays off big time. And Trump, interestingly, drew quite a bit of funding from some of the big venture capital firms, most notably Andreessen Horowitz is one of the biggest two VC firms. So the connection here is that the venture capital world has increasingly pumped money into small defense tech startups, so that apart from the big tech companies, you know, the SpaceX, Elon Musk's firm, Google, Microsoft, and these companies, you've got literally dozens and dozens of small startups funded by these largely Silicon Valley-based venture capital funds. So they're jumping on board very quickly. I think they're going to have a huge influence in shaping US military policy. You know, one could say that it was that this has been long overdue, that the legacy, the old defense firms were just too stuck in the past, stuck in their ways. and that this is what the Pentagon needs, but I have many concerns about where this is headed, not just because of artificial intelligence and AI-enabled weapon and surveillance systems, but also because of the lack of transparency that I think will come along with this inevitably, and the forms of accelerated warfare that we're likely to see going forward.
Yeah, if Gaza and Ukraine are indicators of just the killing fields that are created by this kind of warfare. And even though the face of the military industrial complex is changing, as you indicate, this is still a huge drain on the public treasury, the U.S. military budget, which all of these capitalists lining up to feed at the trough will at least continue, if not accelerate. And so what, Professor Gonzalez, as an anthropologist, do you have to offer in terms of thinking about how we replace the war-based economy and culture with one that is peace-based?
Well, I'm glad you asked this question. It's a great question, and this is partially why I got into this area, which is fairly uncommon, I think, for a cultural anthropologist to dive into the world of the military-industrial complex. Of course, as you mentioned earlier, my position is very critical, and my critical perspective and my criticism is largely informed by my experience in having the opportunity to live in societies that are very different from ours and to learn from them. And so, you know, if we take one example, we can travel to most Western European countries and find that if you've traveled at all through a place like the Netherlands, for example, you find that the infrastructure is just, for example, the train system to get from one area to another, very efficient, very inexpensive. There's all kinds of elements of infrastructure, elements of public education. There are other ways that tax dollars can be spent other than this massive military outlay, which is now in approximating $1 trillion or approaching $1 trillion a year in the United States. But think of how all of that could be used to invest in other parts of our society. Again, education, the healthcare system, climate change mitigation, you name it. All of these alternatives are being squandered because of the huge amounts of taxpayer money that have gone to the military-industrial complex. In the past, you know, the Lockheed Martins and the Boeings and the BAE Systems and the Raytheons. In the future, very likely, the Microsofts and the Amazons and the Googles. So this, is, of course, is a huge concern. And creating a peace-based economy, I think, is going to take all of us raising those questions, making those criticisms, thinking about those alternatives, creating our own alternatives locally as well, if our federal government is not going to provide the support that we need. I think also that the incentive structures need to change. I think we as a society need to think about how to make a peace-based economy. What are these incentives for doing that? What are the incentives that will get our politicians diverting more of those funds away from defense and towards the kinds of real human needs that our society has?
Well, thank you so much. And I know locally that this week, the Oregon Investment Council is meeting and lots of folks are planning to call attention to the Oregon Investment Council's investments in war producing industries and Israel bonds and so on to try to redirect those investments to more productive uses. And often on this show, I recommend the Costs of War Project, which I know, Roberto, you have published, or you're a fellow of the Brown University Costs of War Project, and also the National Priorities Project, where people can look up how tax dollars coming from Oregon could be redirected into public housing, education, food assistance, all kinds of more positive uses, social uses. So thanks so much for joining us today, Roberto Gonzalez. We'll link to some of your work on the Old Mole Variety Hour page on the KBOO website. Thanks again.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Lori. I was happy to talk with you.
Thanks a lot.